Thank you for listening to The Path to Authenticity. My name's Tom Gentry. I think of this show as the opposite of small talk. You'll hear real conversations with real people who know who they are. We talk about what makes them who they are, how they became who they are, and how we might become truer expressions of who we are.
I'm author Gregory B. Davis, and this is The Path to Authenticity.
If this is your first time here, thanks for listening. If not, thanks for coming back. I'm Tom Gentry, and this is Episode 82 of The Path to Authenticity. So this episode features a conversation with Gregory B. Davis. It took place on Tuesday, the 11th of August. And earlier that day, I lost someone who meant a lot to me, a guy named Jim Moore, who was the CEO of this facility in Nashville where I worked. It's called Cumberland Heights. It was a fantastic facility that he ran for over 20 years and just turned it into this incredible place. And he's just the kind of leader who you don't encounter very often. Just a great guy, and is giving and is willing to help. His generosity of spirit, it's like you just don't see it. Such a special guy, and he was really good to me. So, and he was a giant in the world of substance abuse treatment. So it was a pretty sad day, and it's been a tough week. Hated to see him go out the way that he did. Sad story, but God bless you, Jim. We love you. I hope you rest in peace. So I couldn't get into this episode without talking about that. It was a busy day, had a lot going on, and it kind of culminated in this conversation with Gregory, which I really enjoyed. He's someone who sought to be a guest on this podcast, and I appreciate his enthusiasm for it so much. You know, I guess I envisioned at some point this podcast would be like that, that it would be something that people would want to take part in, but I definitely don't take it for granted. So I want to thank him for doing this with me. So I hope you enjoy it. Here you go. Gregory B. Davis.
Just the product of some bad seeds.
I'm very well, Tom. How are you today?
I'm doing pretty well. I appreciate you taking the time to come on the podcast. And, you know, you're an author, and can you tell the folks the title of your book?
Yeah, I am an author. I'm a new author. This is my first book. I'm super excited to have it out there.
Congratulations.
The title, yeah, thanks. The title of the book is Fight or Flight, Make Better Decisions to Enjoy Your Life.
So, you know, I love the concept. When I started to dig in a little bit and see where you kind of start off from a place of, you know, if we start from a rational position when we make decisions rather than an irrational or an emotional position, or, you know, then we have a better chance at flourishing. And, you know, it's interesting. Because I'm pretty big on emotional literacy. right? Mm-hmm. I'm a pretty big advocate of we have to stop ignoring our emotions and suppressing our emotions and instead experience our emotions. But I also think because as a culture, we're not great at that, we tend to more ignore them. Then they come out in messy sort of ways. And we end up voting for people who shouldn't be president or, you know, or making any number of irrational decisions based on some emotional attachment to something long ago that, that really has nothing to do with what's best for us right now.
That's right.
And people do it in romantic relationships constantly.
That's the kind of the point I wanted to make, because that's where I think it does the most damage to ourselves and our loved ones, is in our closest relationship is where it pops up the most.
Mm-hmm. So, and you know, you use the analogy of the boxer and becoming, you know, boxers become, because they box and they are, you know, it's a life-threatening exercise, then the fight or flight impulse becomes inoperative. They let go of that and transcend that. And so you're encouraging people to learn that lesson and do that themselves, right?
That's exactly right. I think the adrenal gland or flight or flight response comes up whenever we think we're in danger or fear. And it was made eons ago. It was designed for us to save our lives when a dangerous situation. However, our brains can't tell a difference between danger and fear very well. And so it pops up today in time in fearful situations. And so if the boxer relies on adrenaline the entire fight, they'd be throwing wild punches, they'd be running in circles, and they would wear themselves out, and they wouldn't have a clear head to think about what was coming next. And that's exactly the point I wanted to make with the book, is that it's, you do have the ability, everyone has the ability to take a deep breath, to regain some composure, and then make the best decision for you long-term instead of that short-term thinking, because that short-term thinking is all about survival. And it doesn't work well for your loving relationships.
Yeah. So where do you think experiences, traumatic experiences, fit into all this?
Oh, that's a tough one. You know, I don't claim to be a medical professional in any way, shape, or form. I just did a whole lot of research on the fight or flight adrenal gland. But I think that anything traumatic, especially in childhood, will be with us forever unless we do a whole lot of healing work, but it's always going to be a part of who we are. And you, it's just the awareness and being conscious that that's a part of your story and who you are, and be aware of how it comes up in your life and when, gives you an opportunity to do something different. And that simple opportunity to do something different, if the last time you had a fight for half an hour didn't work so well, what can we do differently next time we get in the situation with our loved one? So no matter our past, we can have a different outcome on with our loved one, so that we both have an improved relationship instead of damaging it just a little bit more.
You know, I started to ponder that question as I was reading, you know, where you saw that fitting into all this, because, you know, being someone who's, you know, that's a topic of discussion in my line of work, trauma, absolutely, quite often. And, you know, people who have been traumatized, you know, they survive those situations and then adapt to protect themselves and then respond from that place. And then, you know, especially when it's in relationships, then, you know, the, because you're an adult now, the things that happened in your childhood, the people around you now aren't necessarily threats like whoever was back then, but you're still responding from that place of fear, you know?
I don't know if you'll agree completely with me, Tom, but I really believe that that little boy or that little girl is still alive within inside of us. And so whatever happened to that child, in this case, it could be a whole lot of different situations, is still real for that person in their life.
Absolutely, yeah.
And until they get clarity that, like you said, like this person standing in front of me is not the person, they will never put me in danger. Now, that's the key. They will never put me in danger. Then the fight or flight response has no place in the relationship. Right. And you have to push that aside, say, okay, I'm not in danger. This is fear.
Right.
And this, it doesn't work for me to create a closer relationship out of fear. It never works.
Right. Well, and you know, what often happens instead when you can't make that adjustment is that people will, recreate the trauma over and over again and create this self-fulfilling prophecy. And then, you know, we project our reality onto the people around us. That's, you know, if we're not careful.
I'd like to say that just a little different way from the point of the view of the book is that what our fight or flight response sets up in our key relationships, let's just go with our partner, our closest relationship. What it sets up is if we have an unknown event, which I say in the book, and it's fearful, it sets off that adrenal gland. Then we either move into fight. So we have that verbal fight, that verbal conflict that we've had 500 times and we'll have 500 more times. Or we move into flight and we shut down. One of them or both people shut down emotionally.
Right.
And it can be recreated, like you said, forevermore if the people in the relationship don't take a step back and engage that logical thinking part of the brain.
Hmm. So how did you get here? How did you arrive at this place where this became such a huge focus for your work, this topic? Mm-hmm.
So that's a great question. I work, well, it's a difficult time for everybody in COVID times, but I work in personal growth. And one of the processes that we taught, The Wall is the name of it. And every time we taught it, I saw it's about the adrenal gland and relationships. Every time I taught it, every time I spoke about it, I could see light bulbs going off.
Mm.
And people, whoever would hear it, could take it as a really simple idea and take it into their lives. And instead of having the same conflict over and over again, they could say, oh, here I am one more time. And I remember thinking about this, and I need to decide to create a really safe and trusting environment for my loved ones so that we can talk about things. We can both talk about our dreams. We can both talk about our passions and joys and wants. Because so often whenever we get into those really idea driven or really thought driven or feeling driven places, I'm going to have different positions than my wife is.
Mm-hmm.
And we're not going to line up exactly. And therefore, it's real easy to get into fear rejection. And then neither one of us gets what we want out of the relationship. And our dreams suffer. And the relationship suffers. And we end up talking about small talk, to the weather, the children, the stock market. And we leave all those really big, really huge dreams in our life just laying by the wayside and forgotten about.
Yeah. Yeah, it's amazing how, you know, in our culture, one of the reasons I wanted to do this podcast is that so many people in our culture just kind of give up.
Oh, yes.
They just give up on love. They give up on career and
themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's the essence of it. And it's, And it really just boils down to conformity, you know, this is the way things are done. So this is the way I'm supposed to do it. And, and if I don't, it will be a threat to the people around me and I will, you know, or I'll risk being abandoned by them or whatever. And so there's so much pressure just to comply with the status quo. And parents put a lot of pressure on their kids, to get the degree or to become the doctor or the attorney or whatever the case may be. And, you know, and it's just, it's so sad to me to see people just give up on life. But I think so often we think that when we do that, okay, so I'm not going to be the Major League Baseball player or whatever it is. But I'll marry her and that will fill the hole. Or I'll buy the jet ski and that will fill whatever it is, the Lamborghini. And that's it, never works. The hole will never be full.
It works for a day or so and then you have a bigger hole because you never took care of the first hole.
Yeah.
And it leads, and then the saddest part, just to take your thought a little further, the saddest part for me is someone, you know, on their last day on this earth, looking back and think, oh, if only, you know, if only I had. And that for me just tears my heart out, you know? And, cause all we have is the right here, right now. And we have to do our very best in this moment to move us forward. It took me 4 years to write this book. I'm very proud of that. 4 years of right now. And finally a dream came true. I was a little dyslexic boy growing up. And to hold that book in my hands when I had trouble reading and spelling and writing on board and I hid, you know, I was the good little boy in school. To hold that book in my hand was like, I mean, it sounds a little funny saying it now, but it was a dream come true, and it was. I had a dream to write a book, and finally I did it.
Well, and that feeling that you're talking about is what the people who give up are depriving themselves of. That is that sad.
And that's what drives us forward in life, I think, are those goals, the big ones and little ones. They drive us forward. They're like the gas of life, to want more, to do more, to build bigger, to motivate people, to give it away. That's what life's about, right? For me, anyway, that's what life's about for me.
So 4 years. So what was the hardest part about it? What was the biggest?
The hardest part, well, the thing that pops in my mind, Tom, about the hardest part would be dealing with all those internal voices and thoughts about who's going to read this, who's going to really get something out of this, who's going to want to talk about this. And that was like kind of for a couple of years, probably like the daily battle to sit down and write. Is it worth it? You know, does it really matter? Does it really matter at all? Am I going to make an impact? And that was kind of the deal I wanted to make with that I made with myself is I want to know that one person picked up this book, read it, and made a change that had a better life. And that's all I wanted to know. Every year, that's all I want to know is that one email. And so I've gotten that email for this year, so I'm feeling like a true winner. But that's probably the hardest part of getting over, I think, the internal battle. In many ways, shapes, or form is what holds us back in life from everything we want.
And it's all fear.
All fear. And that goes exactly back to what kicks off the fight, the flight in our lives is that fear.
And then, you know, if you fly, if you take flight and you don't write the book, you know, then again, you don't get to experience that validation, satisfaction, you know, just pride in yourself for having followed through. I mean, this is, you know, I haven't had the same experience as you, but I also write, and that this is definitely one of those things that I know when that happens, it's going to mean a lot to me to hold the book in my hand.
Yeah. It will. Yeah. It's a mountain you have to climb. You know, it really is.
Yeah.
And if you got it inside of you, for those of you who are listening, you got it inside of you, just keep at it one day at a time, one piece at a time. And because it's worth it, the payoff, the self-fulfillment, the self-confidence is just something I'll be proud of for the rest of my life.
Well, and for me, and I've covered sports for a couple newspapers when I was younger. I have somewhat of a journalism background. And so I've done some writing, and I've kind of always known there was going to be a book, but I knew what I didn't want it to be, but I wasn't sure what it should be. And I wanted it to help people. I knew that. That to me needed to be the motivation for it. And you know, I just beat myself up so much for years because I hadn't written it yet. Mm-hmm. And eventually, maybe 3 or 4 years ago, it just hit me, you know, you haven't written it yet because you weren't ready to write it yet. And the book you'd write today is nothing like the book you would have written 15 years ago. And I learned at that point to just kind of trust my inner wisdom a little bit and just keep putting one foot in front of the other and allow it to happen instead of just being so hard on myself.
Yeah.
You know?
That doesn't serve anybody. It's not your best, not to be at your best. And I think it all, like, our conversation keeps coming back around to the same point, I think, is that internal guide has to be like hushed and quieted down so you can move forward into outside of that comfort zone and into the next place of greatness that's setting up in your life. That's what I believe about everyone.
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. I mean, people who've listened to a lot of this show, you mentioned earlier what I refer to as the inner child, and what you just talked about is what I would refer to as the inner critic. Mm-hmm. And, the first guest I had on the podcast was an author named Lucia Capicchione. Mm-hmm. And I feel like I mention her in almost every episode, but you know, she wrote a book called Recovery of Your Inner Child, and she refers to it more as the inner family. But, you know, because there is a critical parent. Who do you think you are? Why, you know, you can't do that. Or, you know, these voices that will just dominate us if we don't own them and, you know, make them inoperative when they need to be, you know, or comfort that inner child or whatever it is that needs to be done. But that inner child is our essence. Mm-hmm. You know, it is our authentic foundation. Self. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you taught these seminars, and this was something that you saw was an important message to convey that a lot of people could benefit from because you saw it in their faces. Mm-hmm. So, and now going back to being a little boy, like, what was it like to make a decision to write a book after you had that experience, which is a traumatic experience in life to, you know,
it defined who I was. Probably until my mid-20s. It was, I grew up in a household that was, parents are always on our side, on me and my sister's sides. And reading was a part of life. And I didn't read. Mm. Or I read very slowly and very poorly. And I think it's the kind of what you touched on earlier, the wisdom of my parents to keep it alive with inside of me. And reading is like gaining steam, right? It grows. Your comprehension grows, and mine just grew slowly than everyone else's. And so by them giving me permission to be how I was, the little boy, and read whatever I wanted to read or whatever I could read, and then supporting me in classes, gave me the ability and opened those doors, and they left them open and said, you know, kind of like, do whatever you want to with them, Greg. And finally, when I was ready to take a hold of that situation, that little dyslexic boy, and say, you know what? That doesn't stop me for the rest of my life. Sure, English class was hard. Sure, I will never read in front of a group. Sure, I'll never write in front of a group of people. But that doesn't mean I can't write a really good book that changes people's lives. There's nothing about that. Only I am stopping myself. Only that little 8-year-old little boy is stopping me today, this 45-year-old man, from writing this book. And that just wasn't acceptable to me any longer.
Yeah.
And I kind of just said, okay, I can do this. I can get people around me that love to read, that love to edit, that love to do this and that, that'll do the pieces I'm not good at, but I'm really good at thinking of ideas and presenting complex ideas in a simple, digestible way. And you know what? I finally realized something once, that the world doesn't like hold the fact that I'm a dyslexic against me. It rewards me for my strengths.
Mm-hmm.
And if I hide everything about Gregory Davis from the world because of one little piece, then the world doesn't know my strengths.
Right.
And so I have to get myself out there to show my strengths. And you know what? I found people didn't really care I was dyslexic. It was like, oh, that's cool. Good. Yeah. You know, that's fine. How can I help you, bud? That's what I found. And it took me into my 20s to finally be like, oh, my friends are my friends and they'll support me no matter what.
Yeah. Well, and listening to you, I think about how, I mean, it hit me at one point, I don't know, I'll guess 10 years ago, that, you know, I'm so good at seeing limitations, but I was not good at seeing possibilities for me. Now, I could do it for other people, but for me, I was trained myself to see limitations rather than possibilities. Mm-hmm. And, you know, we're going to find what we're looking for.
Absolutely.
And you know, and part of doing this podcast was, you know, a process of, I'm going to do what I want. Like, mm-hmm. I'm the only one who can do it. You know, nobody's going to do this for me. Mm-hmm. If I go get another 9-to-5 and I never go, like, when am I going to do it if I'm not going to do it now?
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, it's almost like when you take that plunge and you start looking for what is possible, then it becomes easier to see. And then when you're doing what you're supposed to be doing, stuff starts falling into place, and
mm-hmm.
and the next
and people thing, are there to support you.
And the next thing you know, you're getting an email from Mariel asking to have Greg on the podcast, and can I send you his book? It means so much to me to have that happen. It really does.
I believe we're impacting the world in a positive way, which we need more of today in time.
Absolutely.
Kind of the way I present that thought in the book is, like, I want people, like, we'll just take my wife, Marielle, as you mentioned, I want people to think, you know, before you have one of those really important conversations, like, is there any danger in this relationship? No, I'm not in any danger. Okay. If fear comes up for me when I'm talking about this, fear of rejection, fear of confrontation, fear that she doesn't love every single little piece of who I am, then put that aside. Once you start to feel it come up, like, be realistic about it and say, that's just fear. That's just fear. And I need to focus, instead of focusing on my limit, what's going to limit me in this conversation, which is my fear that's inside of me. Focus on the possibilities of a closer relationship, of both of our dreams coming true.
Yeah.
Then we move in the right direction together.
Well, and the other part of it is, when we get sucked into those thoughts, I mean, and it can be endless, mulling over these fears in our brains that will just paralyze us.
Well, it can paralyze us from the point we can get stuck in the same fight the entire relationship and cut off any type of growth, any type of more, any type of dreams coming true. Or, and from a fight or flight perspective, we can shut down. And people live in dead relationships for decades.
Yeah.
And the only way they know to get out of it sometime is to end it. And that is just the saddest state to think that that's the only way out. That's what I refer to in the book as the either or. Either we fight here or I shut down. No, that's not accurate. There is an endless amount of possibilities. But once again, our fight or flight response is tricking us, saying either you fight it out or you flight. You go move into flight. And it's not true. You can find a way out of this that works for both of you.
Yeah, you know, that whole black and white thinking, it's an unhealthy trait.
It is. It becomes a really bad habit.
Yeah, well, and, you know, to go a step further, I mean, if through the lens of codependency, it is a core symptom of codependency. Mm-hmm. It is, and the way, you know, Pia Melody, who was one of the people who's written a lot about that, would she describes it as an inability to experience one's own reality moderately. You know, no gray area. Like, only, you know, it has to be either I'm going to be married to you forever or I'm never going to talk to you again. You know, but think about how often and how easily we can get trapped in that, you know, and it's just another survival thing. I can't deal with this distress, the distress of ambiguity, of uncertainty. So, like, I need to create an answer immediately is really what it is. Mitigating the fear.
Yeah. And what I see is people turn to what I saw in the seminar, in the personal growth seminars, is that people return to the safest topic there is, and that's the children. And that's great for 18 years or whatever, but then guess what happens? Someday the children are gone, and the only topic of conversation is gone, and you're sitting across the coffee table one day staring at each other. Like, who is this person, you know?
Yeah. And it's probably not the best thing for the kids either, you know?
No, valid point, Tom. Really valid point.
I mean, because, you know, when we over attend or whatever, you know, when we're not modeling a healthy relationship for the kids, that's the thing. I'm modeling avoiding the relationship by paying attention to you. And the thing about kids, you can't fool them. Like, they know what's going on when you're doing that. They know.
They know. They know everything. They know a lot more than we realize. So, that's actually where this book started, was with what stress and fight or flight does to children. Mm-hmm. And I did a lot of research into that, and it is very damaging long term to brain development, but it got really complex and so many unknowns for children, you know, that I had to step away from that just a little bit. But it's not good. It's not good for children.
Of course not. So, all right. So, what do you do besides write?
So, we have the personal growth seminars. So I travel around parts of the US and Canada and deliver those. They're intensive 5-day programs. And I love that. And then I'm a father of two and love to take care of myself physically and working on more books now. I've been addicted to this book writing thing.
So what's next?
Yeah, I have. Thank you. Thanks for asking. I have a book coming out in the end of the year called Wisdom is the Beginning. And what I realized with life is, with having kids, is that there's wisdom passed on generationally. And the more wisdom we can, more healthy wisdom and more healthy patterns we can pass on, the bigger advantage we give to those people in our lives. And life is way too short to learn all the lessons that we get to learn in this life. And so I researched like historical thinkers, and I narrowed it down to things that I think people have to deal with their entire life, the breaking of relationships, the difficulties of death of a loved one. And I go and research different thoughts and quotes and add my own thoughts to it. And I hope it gives people a different way to think about life and challenges that they're facing or will face someday.
So how do you define wisdom?
I define wisdom as knowledge, like general knowledge that you can pick up and put into your life to make your life better. And so it's not just to read it. It's not just to like think about it. It's to actually take it in and change a little piece of who you are so that you're more healthy. You see things more wholly. You can get through a difficult situation from a different point of view. Mm-hmm. That's how I see wisdom.
Well, this is, you know, I love words, first of all, like, and I love this definition of wisdom that I picked up somewhere. Knowledge combined with love. You know, having, you know, which is something that's where the time comes in, I think, to have the perspective, to be able to add that element of love to it.
Man, you could get a whole way lot far down the road of life with knowledge and love, can't you?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Absolutely. And, you know, this is another one of the topics that I'm really interested in and have done some writing about and working on projects around is manhood, you know, and the state of modern manhood and where we need to go with it. And, you know, I think there's a lot of stuff out there right now about it that's good, you know, that I take bits and pieces from, but I feel like there's a broader message that can be conveyed and reach more people. But I think one of the things that's really missing, and I try to address this in my work, is mentorship and and, you know, as men, we need the admiration of older men.
Absolutely.
And we don't always get that as, you know, and, you know, men, we don't know how to love ourselves. We don't know how to love each other. Like we're not good at it. And we really need to learn how to do a better job of teaching each other how to be men and showing up for each other.
You're hitting on a big button of mine, Tom. About 10 years ago, I wanted to put together a men's weekend and hit on a lot of things you're talking about. And I did, and I've done a number of them. Just get like about 30 men together and talk about what, you know, I think the definition of a man was very clear about 50 years ago. And since then, it's become much more convoluted. And especially if you consider society and advertising, the messages that are sent to men, it can get really, really difficult. But I think that it comes down to me as mentoring. It comes down to me for men to have like two friends that they can say anything to talk about what's going on in their lives, not sports, not beer, whatever it might be. Talk about really important things. And men are really bad, generally speaking, men are really bad at creating those couple relationships. They have their wives or their loved ones, and that's about it. But that doesn't work so well.
Yeah, you know, I did an episode a while back with this journalist named Cleo Stiller, and she wrote a book called Modern Manhood. And the title of the episode, because this came up in our conversations, Dad Has No Friends. You know, we reach a place in life, by and large, American men, where, you know, we have our wives and that's about it.
Like, and that's great.
It's not enough to have one intimate relationship. When I say intimate, I mean depth, feeling, you know, Yeah, we need more than that. And it is too much for us to expect of one human being to be able to meet all of our needs.
Yeah. It's just, and there are male issues, there are male challenges that my wife can't help me with, and I right. need other men in my life to give me insight.
Absolutely. Yeah. So you've navigated that. So how did you come to the conclusion that you needed to?
As far as having other men to,
you wanted to do the weekends and all that stuff. How'd you come upon that?
I did. It hit me in the face hard. I had good friends. And, the time it came really clear to me, Tom, was, and it's in the book in pieces, is I was 33. My life was awesome. I was married. I had a dog, I had an apartment, I had a great job. And I had really had my dream job in many ways. And I was traveling to Mexico City every week, working down there. And I started to get some uncomfortable feelings in my abdomen. And like a good guy did, I just ignored them. And it went away, and then it came back. And so I went to a urologist, and he said, "Oh, I'm sure you're fine." And I remember this so clearly. He sat down on the stool, and he made a few notes after a physical examination. And he looked up to me and he said, "You have cancer and you need to be on an operating table as soon as possible." And that was not part of my plan. I always ate healthy. I always exercised. And in that moment, I knew everything in my life was going awesome. In that moment, I knew nothing.
Wow.
And I remember going home, and my wife was going into class, and I didn't say a word to her. And I sat in the apartment and I was like, what am I going to do now? I was supposed to be on an airplane the next day. And a really good friend of mine popped in my head. And he worked right down the street. And I called up Adam and I said, "Adam, I need to talk to somebody." And he dropped everything in the middle of his workday and came over and spent a couple of hours talking to me about it. And in that moment, just by me saying the words out loud, helped me make some really good decisions. And it proved to me in the moment that I need other men in my life at times, and that there's some things that I need to talk about. And I could have sat in that apartment all day. It's fun.
Yeah.
But luckily there was a man there for me that had my back, that stepped in and helped me out when I really needed it.
Yeah. Wow. So you're writing another book. Sounds like you have many other books.
I do.
Anything else that exciting that's up and coming for you?
I think that's a good question. I feel like life is such a standstill right now. I'm so thankful for the books. And my mode is to help my wife get back and start obtaining some of her dreams in life. And then to get my little boy started into kindergarten.
Oh, man.
And I'm really loving life right now. I'm really loving life the way it is. And I really love being a father.
Mm.
And so I'm going to spend every much time with him as I can until he's done, you know, starts pushing me away, which I know is coming down the track. And
I'm there.
I'm not ready, but I know it's coming. So that helps me in a lot of ways.
I have a 14-year-old who beginning his freshman year in high school. But I was like you, you know, I speaking of other men, you know, there was a guy who I worked with on a daily basis for a number of years. And while his mom was pregnant for him, you know, it was exciting becoming a dad. I always wanted to be a dad. You know, this guy and I, we'd be talking business, and we'd end up talking about how much he loves being a dad and how excited I am. And one of the things he said to me is he talked about how when his daughter was born, he would volunteer to be the one to get up in the middle of the night when she cried, and he just savored it.
Mm-hmm.
And And he said to me, you know, just enjoy it.
Mm-hmm.
Just enjoy it. And that was like the perfect thing to be told, because I took that and I was intentional. I mean, there's so many times I've looked at my son in my life and just thought, God, I love him so much. And I'm so grateful to be his dad. And just taking it in.
That's wisdom right there in my book.
Yeah.
You know, really
wise. Yeah. 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 I mean, and you know, there's nothing better than that.
I do teen camps from the seminar, and a part of the teen camp is, it's from 8 till 15 years old. And the teens get to ask their parents for something that the parent can do to improve the relationship.
Ooh.
No exaggeration. 90% of the time, it has something to do with the child wanting more time, more quality time with the parent. Yeah. And so I took that to heart. Like you did, I got that message loud and clear. So I spend all the time I can right now, because I believe it's fleeting very quickly.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and that's another thing that, you know, being a guy who works with a lot of young men, who have addictive behaviors, you know, not winning at life. I mean, things are going bad. And invariably, you know, that was missing, you know, and it wasn't always the dad, but, you know, a lot of times it was the dad. And, and a lot of times it was a dad who was a very high achiever and was out making a gazillion dollars a year because he wanted to provide for his son when all his son wanted was to spend time with him. And so I learned that lesson before I ever became a dad. I knew it inherently anyway from having a dad who I wanted to have more time with. But, I remember when my son was very little, sitting on the couch one day, and I'm walking through the living room, and he pats the seat next to him on the couch and looking at me, and he says, "Come here, be with me, be with me." And you know what? I stopped what I was doing and I went and sat with him, and I'll never forget that, because it was so clear. Be with me. That's all kids want from us, really.
Yep.
That's all they want. And, you know, and it's a wound if we don't give them that one thing that they want. It is.
It's a wound, because it's not going to happen once. It happens repeatedly.
Yeah.
And it is a wound. And then they stop asking.
Yeah.
And then that's a loss for both sides.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you know, my experience with that, I'm the youngest of 8 kids. And so, you know, my dad was up there when I was born, and there were already 7 of us, you know. And so he was a great dad, but, you know, we only probably played catch like twice. And instead of him like taking me fishing, and it was other kids' dads who were doing that kind of stuff with me. And I, you know, in doing some of deep, deep work, therapeutic work myself over the last few years, kind of remembered how I would go to my older brother who lived out of town. He would come back and he'd visit. I would go to him and ask him to play catch. He'd be sitting next to my dad. And it clicked to me a few years ago, like, even as a little kid, I knew what I really wanted was my dad. Mm-hmm. But I'd learned already to stop asking. And I was asking my brother because I knew he'd say yes. I was starved for it, you know? We do. That's what happens. You know,
I hope the fathers out there are listening to that message, because it hits right on. And
yeah.
They need to jump up and join the boys.
Yeah. Well, and for me, And I've been pretty direct with my son about this at times because, you know, we haven't had everything. You know, there are years of my career when I could have been making a lot more money, but it would have meant being on the road a lot. It would have meant not having as much time with him. And every time I chose him. Mm-hmm. And he knows that, you know, he knows that. And, you know, there's some downsides to it too, but like, you know, being a kid, he might not want it, but when he's my age and he's looking back, you know, he'll see it.
He'll be thankful. Yeah, and he'll be a better father for it too, I believe.
Yeah. Well, and he knows he's loved. Mm-hmm. And he's flourishing. You know, I mean, that's that, because that's really what it takes. You know, that's really what we all need is love.
That's the payoff for him. Yes, he has the base, the foundation,
right,
to flourish in life because you sacrifice for him in many ways.
And you know, his mom's done great too. But
yeah,
but that's, you know, I've definitely tried to do my part, and it hasn't always been easy. But it, you know, it's such a great experience to be a parent. It really is.
It is, and work is such a challenge. It's such a balancing act. I think. Especially, well, for whoever the breadwinner is in the family, you know, it's the most socially acceptable addiction we have in our society is workaholic, you know, people who are just, and it's,
well, it's celebrated.
If you get a pat on the back. Yeah. You get a pat on the back. Right.
Yeah.
But there's a trade-off. There's a big trade-off.
Well, and you know, there's a lot of, you're starting to see things in popular culture about how unhealthy that is, you know, and, you know, seeing things out there in magazines about how important it is to rest and how dysfunctional it is to never stop, which is behavior that's rewarded in our culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the other thing from an emotional standpoint, I mean, some of the unhealthiest people I know are the ones who are in some ways the most productive because they never stop. They're constantly doing something. And, you know, I learned a long time ago, I mean, I've used that as a coping skill at times when I was so upset that I didn't want to experience whatever emotions, you know, so I'd work. I knew, you know, I had to stop and feel. Sometimes we have to stop and feel, or, you know, like, the analogy that I use sometimes is the one about if we don't heal our own wounds, we end up bleeding all over the people we love.
Yeah, they come out in weird ways, right?
They do.
They
do.
It's like I see it as like a weed, and until we get down like really deep into the root system and clean it up, it's just going to keep coming up and polluting the joy of the day, that past.
Ugh. Well, I'll tell you, one of the things I've enjoyed about this conversation is that we have all the same beliefs, but we use different language.
That's true.
Yeah. I knew it immediately when I started reading your book that it was going to be a good conversation. So looking back on your life, when was the time when Gregory needed support, a word of advice? When would that have been, and what would you go back and tell him?
Mm-hmm. I can remember when I think I was a freshman in high school, pretty sure, and being a dyslexic boy, having dyslexia, I needed support. I needed certain things from my teachers, and I always got it. But the process of sitting down with my teachers at the beginning of the year was just, I saw it as embarrassing when I was that. I didn't want to have dyslexia. I didn't want to deal with those things. And I can remember walking into a conference room in the first week of school. My parents were behind me and opening these doors open. And there, all my teachers and my coach for the year sitting at this table, just looking at me and my parents were huge for me self-advocating, for them not talking, for me talking. Mm. And I was scared to death. And if I could go back and just like put my hand on Mom Gregory's head or like on his back and say, buddy, you do not understand how much this is going to pay off in the future. You do not understand how powerful you are and how this is just one little stepping stone into how big your life's going to be. Just hang in there and keep doing it. And you're on the right path, because it didn't feel like the right path at that time. Yeah. It felt like I was all by myself in a dark wilderness, which wasn't true. But that little boy couldn't see the light at that moment.
Man, it can be really scary to be a little kid, can't it?
It was scary. It was scary with all those adults, you know?
Yeah.
They were on my team, but I just couldn't see it. That,
yeah. Well, this has been great. I hope you've enjoyed it as much as
I loved it. I loved it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for coming on.
I appreciate it. Yeah. I appreciate your time. I thank you very, very much. And I look forward to our next conversation.
Thanks for listening to The Path to Authenticity. If you'd like to learn more about our guest, you can find links in the show notes or visit our website at thepathtoauthenticity.com. If you're interested in becoming a sponsor, if you have a suggestion for a topic, or you know someone who would make a great guest, email the show at thepathtoauthenticity@gmail.com. If you enjoyed this episode, please leave a review on Apple Podcasts. If you know someone else who would enjoy the show, or even just a particular episode, please share it with them. Every little bit helps. If you're not already a subscriber, please consider becoming one wherever it is you choose to listen. You can find the show on Patreon, where by becoming a patron, you can hear episodes before they're released publicly. You can gain access to supplemental content. There are other benefits in the various tiers. Visit patreon.com/thepathtoauthenticity. Join our Facebook community or follow the show on Instagram, both at The Path to Authenticity. We also have a YouTube channel. You can connect with us on Twitter or Pinterest. To hear the songs from this and every episode, you can find the Path to Authenticity playlist on Spotify. Obviously, there are a lot of ways you could be spending your time, so I appreciate you spending some of it here with me. I'm Tom Gentry. Thanks for listening. Be nice.
did great, honeybee.
The Path to Authenticity is powered by Equivox. For digital marketing and web design services, visit equivox.com.